Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 11:27 a.m. That is Pacific Summer Time. Today is September 14th, and of course, being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Well, I thought that this week I would really focus on the very long term. I'm conscious of the fact that over the last few weeks I've been really more looking at the outlook over the next few months or even the next year or two. But rather, I think on this occasion, I'd like to really focus on the very long term. So when we look at, for example, the S&P 500 over the course of almost 100 years, we can see very clearly that there have been very prolonged periods where it ranges, and then there have been very prolonged periods when it trends higher. Well, if we just simply think about this in terms of the long-term cyclicality of the markets, then we could then conclude pretty clearly that we're now in one of those lengthy trending phases. Well, generally speaking, those trending phases can last anything upwards of 15 to 20 years following the breakout to new highs. So for example, if we take the breakout to a new all-time high, it was in 1954, the market didn't eventually peak until 1972. So that was a long period. Then even if we were to simply take the break above the 20-point level on the S&P 500 and at the beginning of the ranging phase, it's still a prolonged period. Then we had the breakout to new high ground in 1980 and a peak in 1999-2000, so another very prolonged period of stock prices advancing. Well, we had the breakout to new highs in 2013, so 5 years ago, and what that suggests is that there's still plenty of time for prices to continue to rally. Well, that's despite the fact that there are significant fears that are continue to be expressed. Well, Ben Bernanke, for example, was writing an article in for the Brookings Institute this week, and he was basically making the point that the housing crash was not a sufficient reason for the kind of collapse and bank run that we saw during the credit crisis, but rather it was the drying up of credit within the system. Well, what does that tell us? It tells us that some of the most important policymakers in the world have drawn some clear conclusions from the credit crisis, and that is that the number one thing that you don't do is restrict credit, and that the most likely scenario is that whenever we do get a recession, that they are going to flood the market with additional liquidity. Quite at what rate the interest rate is when that happens is rather beside the point, because they're going to cut the interest rate aggressively and they're going to boost liquidity in order to allay any potential fears. There is, of course, the other, I think, rather important point is that US banks today are not nearly as leveraged as they were during the last crisis. So when we think about what it is that is likely to cause the next problem in markets, it's unlikely to be over leverage within the US banking system, because they're nowhere close to that kind of leverage today. That doesn't mean that we're not seeing a return to securitization. There's increasing appetite for securitization within the US and the Chinese markets. The market for securitization in Europe was basically sponsored by the ECB when it began to engage in its quantitative easing program. There simply wasn't enough of securitized loans that the ECB could buy. That was a green light to anyone who could securitize even credit card debt, boat loans, car loans, house loans, to do so, because the ECB would buy them. Well, when we think about it in those terms, there's potential for continued growth in securitization, but it's not at levels that are likely to represent a significant threat to the US economy. That, of course, does not mean that it isn't going to be a problem somewhere else. When we think about where it is that we could have a problem in future, well, the clear underperformance that we've seen recently has been in China, and then followed by Europe, and then I think we have to consider that some of the reason that emerging markets have been pulling back is because of their reliance on business from China. So, if we're going to think about where the potential problems lie, well, the chances are that it's less likely to be in Wall Street, but rather somewhere else. Well, when we think about this long-term cyclicality that we have on the S&P 500, we don't quite have the same quantity of long-term data for other markets. But it is perhaps, I think, useful to look at, for example, the FTSE All Share. It does not have as much long-term data as we have on the S&P 500, and if just see just how much data we do have. Well, it goes back to 1960. Let's see if it goes back any further. Well, the reality is that here also we have that lengthy rangy phase in the 60s through to 1978. Then we had a significant bull market all the way through to 1999, and it has really only just broken out in the last year or two. Now, if we take the log scale chart off, well, we can see that there was a really quite lengthy range, and the depreciation of the pound following the Brexit announcement was largely responsible for the breakout that we've seen over the last couple of years. Then, when we look at what's going on in Europe, well, the Euro Stoxx index just simply hasn't been around all that long. So, when, for example, we look at these longer term charts, well, we're just not going to get the data going back to the 1970s. But what we are presented with is a very lengthy range. And generally speaking, these lengthy ranges, especially when you've got a consolidation at the upper side of the range, well, the balance of probabilities would be that it is going to then break upwards. But the problem for Europe is that the internal cohesion of the market, and considering that this is a pan-European index, it's just looking at all the shares or all the largest shares within the continent of, or at least within Western Europe. But it doesn't give us a particularly good perspective on exactly what's going on within the Eurozone. For that, we can look at the Euro Stoxx index, which is comprised of approximately 340 shares. And when we look at that, then we don't have that nice range. What we're presented with, in fact, is a progression of lower rally highs and a rather profound volatility. Now, the very big question for these markets is whether they're going to, in fact, be able to hold the lows. Well, we did get something of a bounce in here, but the problem here is that this is a potential type 3 top formation evolving here. And it really is going to have to sustain the move above 400 for confidence to be renewed. Well, Europe really has been out in the wilderness for the last few years because of all the problems that it has with debt. And I think that is something that we need to be aware of. But let's then focus on some of the other very long-term charts. If we were looking for additional evidence that there is going to be a lengthy period where stocks will outperform, well, the Dow Gold Ratio gives us a really very compelling graphic illustration of exactly what's going on, because a very important secular peak was hit in 1999. And generally speaking, when we look at these peaks in performance of equities versus gold, well, we have this consistency, or at least, and well, I think because it's such a long chart, we have two examples of these intervals of being approximately 35 years. Well, then the ballpark figure for the next peak in stocks versus gold or commodities generally is probably going to be somewhere in the mid-2030s. And if that is indeed the case, then the other thing that we also can see very clearly on this chart is that there is a progression of higher highs. So there is the possibility that by the time this bull market has run its course, the Dow Jones will be trading at more than 40 times the price of gold. Well, the Dow Jones today is at 26,123. 25 points. Now, when we look at this, and I think we really do need to look at it on a logarithmic scale chart to really give us a longer picture of the ranges one above another over this extraordinarily long period of time. Well, what we can see clearly is that there was a lengthy range, and in fact this broke upwards earlier. It was breaking upwards in 2012, and it is still trending higher. Well, we can also go back and look at some of these bull markets that we've had in the past, and there have been lengthy periods when we've had sharp pullbacks followed by rather lengthy ranges. So, for example, there have been 5-year ranges, there have been 3-year ranges or 2.5-year ranges, and that was equally the case in following the pullback in 1987. And that was considered a crash, but it was nowhere near the extent of the kinds of crashes that we've seen within the last 15 years, and it was very quickly unwound. This is also an example of there are two things, lessons I think that we can draw from crashes. One, and I think it goes back to what Ben Bernanke was talking about in his article and in his research report, that it is availability of credit. What the Federal Reserve did in 1987 was flood the market with liquidity. And that ensured that there was ample liquidity, and it stopped a bank run. That allowed the market to remuster the wherewithal to be able to push prices back up again. So that was an important point, and it was quite different from the mistake that was made in allowing Lehman Brothers to go bankrupt in 2008. That decision was something that cost a lot more money in the long run than saving it would have done. That also I think it is important to highlight the point that the banks in the US have certainly had their risk taking curtailed, and therefore they're less risky today than they were then, and that is a positive outcome from the crisis. But the other point is that there is, when you have a crash, it's about degrees of separation from the epicenter of risk. So when you do get these very sharp pullbacks, and particularly in a leading stock market, well, then you get contagion selling. And in a crisis, the correlation goes to one. Well, that doesn't necessarily mean the prices stay down. If you are selling something that you have a profit in, because you have a loss somewhere else, well, that doesn't necessarily mean there's anything wrong with the thing that you're selling, but rather that it's a financial decision. Well, that's when fundamentals start to get really attractive, and then bargain hunters start coming into the more attractive assets, and they start to go back up again. Well, therefore, when we look at some of the pressure that is coming to bear today in the emerging markets, well, that is, I think, one of the other rather important points. If we look at a long-term chart, for example, of the Sensex in India, well, we know that India is very prone to the bouts of extraordinary volatility, but it is also prone to lengthy ranges. And it had a very lengthy range from the early 1990s through to approximately 2005. Then it rallied pretty impressively, going from about 6,000 to 20,000, and then it spent time ranging underneath 20,000 on the Sensex from 2007 until 2014, and then it broke out again. Well, this doesn't necessarily mean that India is about to be absolved from the risk of volatility, but this is another long-term cyclical market where there are lengthy periods where it can trend higher, and then there are lengthy periods where it ranges, but that the upward bias is clear. Well, there are two things that drive this upward bias within an index. The first is inflation, and stocks generally reflect the longer-term inflation rate. And then, of course, you have rotation, that stock market indices are necessarily momentum driven, considering that the vast majority are market cap weighted. So they generally tend to favor the shares that have been doing best. And that then gives them an upward bias over the longer term, because they're insulated from the declines. A leading share declining will have an impact on the market, but then the better performing shares will overtake the weighting within the index and it will start to go back up again. Well, that was something that it was the concentration of the technology sector within the NASDAQ contributed to its extraordinarily lengthy range between the bottom that was reached in 2000 and it breaking up out above the 2000 level on a sustained basis in 2010. This is also a very good example of the psychological perception stages of major bull and bear markets. Well, when we think about this lengthy range, despite the fact that the market rallied from 1,000 to 2,000, it took a lot of convincing for people to think that this was a new big bull market, and then the price gave up the entire advance during the credit crisis. But what was important was that the index was pushing on to new highs as early as 2010, whereas the S&P 500 was still struggling to get off the lows. And that relative strength is something that really helped to get people switched on to technology. They didn't necessarily believe it, but the relative strength was something that started to encourage people to get in. If we had talked about the technology sector overcoming the peak seen in 2000 within the space of 6 years, back in 2010, well, nobody would have believed it. So even though the price had broken out, we were not yet in an acceptance stage. This entire lengthy range that persisted for the better part of a decade, well, that was all characterized by disbelief. And disbelief is the first psychological perception stage of a bull market. And then that gives way to acceptance, because you cannot have an index that goes from 2,000 to 4,000 in the space of 3 years and without people really starting to get the idea that something meaningful is occurring. Well, obviously then people start to think about, well, golly, these things have gone up a lot already, and I know how this works. I was still around when the NASDAQ bubble happened the first time around, and when it got up to this level, well, it collapsed, so I'm going to have to sell in here. Well, that worked for a while, but then you have these companies that are literally changing the world. And that's the narrative of every third psychological perception stage, that you must buy today because you need to own a piece of the future. And the only way that you're going to benefit is that if you own this thing, that this is literally going to change the way we live our lives. Well, that narrative is extraordinarily powerful, and it is manifested in a slightly different way in every major bull market. And it's certainly happening today, that you have the fact that Apple is the largest company in the world. Then you have the fact that Amazon is going to cannibalize every other retailer of every product everywhere. And the only way to benefit from that is to own Apple shares. That artificial intelligence is going to conquer the world, and therefore Google is the leader in that. That social media is ubiquitous, that it is influencing elections, it knows better than ourselves what we're going to do with our money, and that the only way to benefit from this change where voting and people are going to be obsolete is going to be to own these shares. So these are the kinds of narratives that people buy into. And they will persist for as long as prices are rising. And one thing that we can clearly see is that the pace of the Nasdaq's advance has picked up since 2016. We had a catalytic event in after the presidential election in 2016, and now the market has accelerated higher, and it continues to push on to new high ground. If we simply look at the trend, then since 2016, it has been really quite consistent. We had a medium-term correction from January through to July, August of this year, and then the market pushed on to new high ground. And it has continued to hold its progression of higher reaction lows. The trend mean coincides with the previous peak. So a reversion back to the mean would represent a pullback to the upper side of the underlying range, and that would probably be viewed by a considerable demographic as a buying opportunity. Then you also have the promises for the future, because the technology cycle is not the same as the market cycle. So the pace of innovation right across the technology sector is not just improving, but it's accelerating. So, for example, Illumina has got, if we look at just simply think about the longer term trend for the share, something very major happened in 2017. The share had been ranging, and it had been ranging with a downward bias until the beginning of 2017, and then something changed. Well, the something that changed was they introduced their newest architecture for genetic sequencing, and they anticipate that that architecture will enable companies to drive the cost of genetic sequencing down from $1,000 to $100. And that's not the end. So they're going to milk this architecture for all it's worth, and then the next iteration will be to take it from $100 to $10. So the pace of innovation in genetic sequencing has left the pace of innovation from Moore's Law and semiconductors in the dust. This has been one of the fastest innovations in a brand new technology in history. And it's going to have a transformative effect on the healthcare sector, because the data that is being consumed and being created as a result of this declining cost of genetic sequencing is truly profound. It is also occurring at the same time that artificial intelligence systems are looking, are improving, but that they work best on very large data sets. Well, healthcare is perhaps the biggest data set there is. There is a project underway. If you think about it this way, there was the Human Genome Project, and that was state-run, and it was very slow, and then you had the introduction of private capital, and it sped up a lot. Then you had for synthetic biology, you had the state-run project to create a synthetic yeast genome, and that was really boring. So then you had the Human Genome Project 2.0, which was to write a human genome from scratch, and that's been completed. Now there is another project to map the human brain. Now the human brain and the connections within it, we're talking about the quantity of data is in petaflops. So it would require all of the computing power that Google currently has at its disposal today to map one brain. So that's an example of just how large the data sets that we're talking about are. And the kinds of calculations that are going to be required, the kinds of innovation that is possible, that are being conceived of, were simply impossible and inconceivable 10 years ago. These are the kinds of things that are going to help to drive the innovation in the healthcare sector. Then you have CRISPR-Cas9 gene editing technology. There is this rumbling IP lawsuit going on between the major players and who discovered it and who's going to have the royalties from it. But the reality is that there isn't a biotech lab in the world that isn't using CRISPR-Cas9 at the moment. And what that is doing is it is massively accelerating the pace with which experimentation and testing of theories can be completed. So that alone is helping to drive innovation within the technology sector. But it's also vitally important because the cost of cancer care is in the order of the second most expensive thing that human beings spend money on outside of energy. So if cancer can be brought under control, if cancer costs can be moderated, that's going to be a big part of the ability of the national healthcare systems to be able to meet the demands that are put on the system, especially in countries that have aging population demographics. Well, then if we look at another really long-term chart, then oil prices are also prone to these extraordinarily long-term ranges followed by bull markets. And oil prices can go sideways for decades. And we saw a very important peak reached all the way back in 2008. That was the top of the last secular bull market in energy. And now we're in another one of these profound ranging phases. And this ranging phase could last for another 20 years. Well, I suppose considering that it's been ranging for 10 years already, and the last one peaked in 1981 and it broke out in 2004, well, it could range for perhaps another 12 or 13 years before being able to sustain a move back above 100. That doesn't mean that prices won't be volatile. They'll be extraordinarily volatile, considering that the amplitude of this range is about $35 to $100. But in order for the price to be able to sustain a move back above 100, not just on a brief period in response to a war, but on a sustained basis, well, that is something that's probably extraordinarily unlikely against the background that we have right now. And the background that we have right now is that US production is trending higher. So this has been a profound change where the US market has gone from being one of the world's largest importers of oil to being almost a net exporter. And this trend higher in oil production in the USA has a secular tone to it. It is outpacing supply growth from both Russia and Saudi Arabia. And this is something that is a complete sea change. It is, I think, completely underappreciated in terms of the impact that it's having on global politics when you have the greatest importer becoming a net exporter. That's something that China is unlikely to ever be able to achieve because it simply does not have the access to either the technology or the reserves to become a net energy exporter. The other advantage that the US energy sector has is that it's privately owned. It is the only very large national sector that is privately owned. And that's something that gives it the potential to grow supply over long term because of the application and the incentive to come up with new innovations. That isn't something that we've really seen elsewhere. Well, if we are in a period where energy is more likely to range than trend on a secular basis, then that removes a headwind to growth. Well, it isn't simply that oil supply is increasing, but that we also have the potential for innovation in the battery sector. That the if the pace of Moore's Law was that you had a doubling in efficiency or a doubling in the number of transistors on a chip every 18 months. Well, the innovation that we're seeing in the genetic sequencing sector is considerably faster than that, but the innovation we're seeing in the battery sector is slower than that. It's approximately every 4.5 years that we get a doubling of battery efficiency. Well, Tesla has introduced, and that's of course on the back of innovation developed by Panasonic, but it has introduced an 8-to-1-to-1 ratio in terms of its batteries. Well, Panasonic is not particularly benefiting from that. This is a share that tends to go sideways and in an incredibly volatile market. Well, if we ask ourselves very simply, is this market trending or ranging? Well, it's ranging, and there's nothing consistent about it. So when we want to find something that has a beautiful chart, this simply does not fit the bill. We don't have the range or the consistency of a trend in order to deploy a trend running strategy. This is only for swing traders, and I think really realistically, the only way people could make money in a chart like this is if they have inside information. And obviously, that's illegal. Well, what we do have with Tesla is a high yield play on energy. And Tesla is, I think, a very interesting share. Because what is the one thing you do when interest rates are really super low is if you want to make a lot of money, you borrow it hand over fist and deploy it in a high-risk strategy. Well, if the high-risk strategy pays off, then you come away with a fortune. And, well, if it doesn't pay off, you go bankrupt. But the company goes bankrupt. It's unlikely that Elon Musk will become bankrupt as a result of it. And the big question is whether Tesla is in fact going to be able to survive. But that is in large part predicated on its ability to continue to fund itself until it, or if it can, get to a position where it can actually make money on its cars. And so far, high yield has been really very steady within the USA. This isn't something that is a particular source of stress right now. If we look at the long-term chart of the high yield sector in the USA, and high yield has really only been around since the mid-1980s, then, and of course it used to be called junk. Well, this range that has been incredibly inert and has persisted for years already has not yet broken out. In fact, it has been trending lower over the last few months. It's not generally until high yield spreads have been rallying for a while that we really get some sense that there is a problem evolving in the markets. So, for example, we had a significant breakout in 1997, and the yield then sustained at higher levels above 500 basis points all the way through 2000, or 1998, 1999, and started breaking out again in early 2000. Well, what this told us was that there was certainly some risk starting to get priced into the high yield sector back then, well ahead of the problems that happened in 2000. Then high yields had been spreads had been trending lower from 2005 through to the middle of 2007, and then they broke out. Then they broke above the 500 basis point level in late 2007 and had been sustaining at rather high levels all the way through to March and even April and May of that year before then exploding on the upside. But the sustained move above 500 basis points was a source of stress. Then in 2011, we had the removal of QE2, and that resulted in this pop higher. Then we had the fact that the Nasdaq was at its all-time peak, and there was the prospect that the Federal Reserve was everyone was worried that they were going to stop or that the economy wouldn't be able to handle the fact that they had stopped purchases, and high yield spreads popped on the upside there as well. And that also did translate into a medium-term correction that could have been a top back in 2015. Since then, the yield spread has come way back down. Well, you'd have to think that it's the 500 basis point level is a big psychological Rubicon for US high yield spreads. And it's not really until we see the level above that that we could really start to think that there's the prospect of a medium term correction that could translate into a medium term peak that may not be resolved for even years at a time. And we're nowhere near that just yet. So I continue to think that Tesla can be considered the canary in the coal mine. As long as it is reasonably steady, then the high yield sector is still okay. And then you have Netflix, which has bounced pretty impressively from the region of the trend mean. Well, Netflix is also in the high yield sector. And it's a B plus, and all of its maturities are bullets, so they're not even callable. But when we look, for example, at the chart of the yield has been trending higher, but not in an aggressive manner. What this also helps to give us a clear indication of is that because high yield spreads haven't been going anywhere, neither have treasuries. And treasury yields have been modestly moving higher over the course of the last few years, but certainly not in an aggressive manner. Well, the very big question that's got to be sitting on the lips of everybody is that if we have this rather sanguine environment where technological innovation is accelerating, where the US banking sector is not as leveraged as it was previously, then we know that we're probably in the third psychological perception stage, not even at the beginning of the third psychological perception stage, but well established inside it, that people really are getting enthused about the life-changing nature of this market. Well, what is it? Where is the fly in the ointment? What is the thing that is looking rather problematic? Well, something that we can certainly think about over this longer term is that from 1980 until 2018, yields have been trending lower. And going from 16 to under 2% is a profound move in the yield for the largest economy in the world. But this was a global phenomenon. So if we look at, for example, the gilt yield in the UK, then we have this trending lower since the early 1990s. And unfortunately, the yield just we don't have the history to go back to the 1980s. For example, if we look at the 10-year on Australia, well, we're presented with a similar pattern where you just have yields coming down on a secular basis for an extraordinarily long time. And that's following the incredible move higher that we had in with the inflation periods in 2000, or sorry, in the 1970s. I'm skipping over my words because I think it's rather interesting the way the chart is growing on the back of the Bloomberg. I've never actually seen that happen before. Well, this has also been an incredible market for the Bunds in Germany. And also here we have this incredible secular decline where the 10-year spent some time in 2016 at negative territory. But if we look at, I've got lots of charts. Unfortunately, they haven't, I'm going to have to go through them to see which ones we have. Well, these are the high yield charts for the global aggregate for high yield that's trending higher. And then if we look at the the similar measure for what we've got. I think I'm going to have to scroll through these to find the one that I want. Well, when we think about the fact that in high yield, we have the countries that own the vast majority of their own debt and have experienced yields coming down on a secular basis. And then there are the countries that don't own the vast majority of their own debt. And those are the ones that are at acute risk from the fact that someone may want to ensure that they get their money back. Well, Japan, Korea, and Switzerland own the vast majority of their own debt. So when people think about the risk that there is outstanding in Japan, well, that's less of a risk in terms of JGB yields, since not only does the do domestic people and domestic banks and the Bank of Japan itself own lots of bonds, but they own the vast majority of those bonds. That's exactly the same in South Korea and Switzerland. Greece is at the other end of this expanse. The ECB owns the vast majority of Greek debt. And Greek banks are trending lower in a dynamic manner. Well, Greek yields haven't moved at all because the ECB is buying all the bonds. Well, then when we look at this chart from another interesting perspective, it's that Italian investors own a substantial quantity of their own bonds, but that's primarily the Italian banking sector. The ECB owns, as a percentage of the outstanding, not quite as much, but then the quantity of outstanding bonds is extraordinarily large, and then the foreign private sector owns about as much as the ECB does. Well, what this also means is that the ECB absolutely needs to see that the European project works, or there are going to be some incredible problems, considering just how much debt from troubled economies that it is holding. Well, that's part of the reason why we have the fact that German yields have been negative. There is a substantial quantity of debt that is still in negative territory. And if, for example, we look at the German rates on just on a tabular fashion, well, we can see that the yield all the way out to 6 years is still negative. So that is how people are hedging the risk that is outstanding in Europe. That is the reason why Europe has not broken up and out of its long-term range, and lots of other markets have, that it has profound challenges that are still outstanding. And the bright spot within the European market has been the export sector. But the export sector is highly dependent on the sustainability of a synchronized global economic expansion. And the reality today is that we just don't have a synchronized global economic expansion. The first indication that that was starting to unwind was at the end of last year, when the South Korean market started to contract. And the unemployment rate in South Korea is starting to rise. They've had to push through a higher VAT rate, and that has contributed to some contraction. But then that was the first of the major economies. It's always interesting to look at what the definition of synchronized global economic expansion is, and it's generally that people look at the 10 biggest economies in the world, and South Korea is the 11th. So it's a little bit more sensitive to what's going on out there in the world, not least because it is such a major exporter. Well, if we look at the long-term chart of the South Korean market, then we're also presented with these lengthy ranges one above another. Well, it did break out in the well, it hit a medium-term peak in 2011, and it broke out in 2016. The very big question is whether it is going to sustain this breakout, but it is right in the region of where that should be realistic to happen, considering that it is now in the region of the upper side of the underlying range. Well, when we think about the fact that South Korea led, and then you've got contractions going on right now in Brazil and Argentina and Venezuela and South Africa, then we can't say that we still have a synchronized global economic expansion. What we do have is an ex economic expansion going on in the USA that has been boosted by fiscal stimulus. That's contributed to the third psychological perception stage of this bull market, that it has been boosted higher by fiscal stimulus. Well, this is the antithesis of counter-cyclical policy. The big question today is whether China is deploying counter-cyclical policy. They have been tightening up on their shadow banking sector, and not least because it had grown so large and so aggressively that it was representing a systemic challenge for the market. But what I'd also like to do is look at the A-share market in Shanghai from a long-term perspective, and then ask ourselves the simple filter questions. Well, if we think about it on this long-term basis, is it giving us evidence of these lengthy ranges followed by big bull markets? Well, I think the answer is yes. It does have these ranges followed by big bull markets. But the peak in 2007 has given way to a very volatile range between 2 and 7,000. And it is starting to come back down towards the lower side of that range. If, on the balance of probabilities, then 2000 should represent a secular low in terms of the worst case scenario for the market, if that long-term cyclicality of the market is going to remain intact. But we don't have the same degree of consistency in China that we do elsewhere, and that brings us to the conclusion that governance really is everything. The kinds of things that we look for in terms of governance are that you have respect for minority shareholder interests, that you have the rule of law. In other words, that you have an independent judiciary so that if your minority shareholder interests are impinged, then you have recourse to have them upheld in court and to get your money back. And then you need to have an independent press in order to air some of the most, I think, grievous examples of corruption. Well, the problem for China is they don't have any of that. What they do have is an administration that tends to have a big picture, and they are now doing something that they haven't done previously. They've given up on transition of power, they've turned into a dictatorship, and they are investing heavily in the policing of the domestic population. That's most particularly being focused on Xinjiang, where there are over 1 million people have been incarcerated out of a population of 12 million people, and there is a massive re-education program underway. Well, that is simply a symptom of what is going on in the wider market, where the application of technology and the profiling, not only of the financial system, but also of people's social media, the camera system that has been set up in all the major cities so that the movement of people can be tracked using artificial intelligence. That is all part and parcel of the fact that they are attempting to squeeze the economy, and that during that process they want to absolutely ensure that they don't have public unrest. Well, when we look at the Shanghai Property Index, and I think we need to do that on a very long-term basis. Well, the asset class that has done best in China has been property, but it doesn't look like it's going up now. In fact, this has been an incredibly volatile period since 2007, and there is an extraordinarily high amount of property that is outstanding in China. That all of, and I do have a graphic to help to illustrate this, but it's This was the graphic I was looking for earlier. It's the quantity of debt that is still trading in negative interest rates. And it's despite the fact that the number or the maturity of bonds has decreased in terms of those that are in negative interest rates. They're still close to a record sum that is at negative interest rates. Well, then if we think about this is leverage loans in the USA and how they're broken down in terms of their rating. And this is corporate debt that's B plus or high yield. Well, you can see that renminbi debt is 26% of the global total, but the vast majority of that debt is property related. So when the banking sector is performing badly, and we can look at that in two ways. You've got the big listed companies that are being state-sponsored, and they have at least had a medium-term low, but this is an extraordinarily volatile range. Now, again, if we think about what it is that we're presented with here in China, it's that there's been this extraordinary pullback this year. The first instincts of a lot of investors would be to conclude that it's time to buy, that this is a medium-term buying opportunity when you see that the banks are starting to do better. But there is one big unknown that we have with China that cannot simply be answered. And it's the fact that you simply do not know, no, that's not what I was looking for, what the story is with the rural banks. Rural banks, the non-performing loans have been trending higher for the last 10 years, and now they exceed the joint stock of banks. So that's an issue. Then if we look at the state-owned sectors, non-performing loans, they've been trending lower over the same amount of time. So what that is representative of is that there's been a transfer of risk from the big state-owned banks to the rural banks, and the rural banks are not listed on the stock market, and we just do not know in real terms how well or badly they're doing. Well, that's problematic when we think about this index, because it doesn't represent where the risk is in the banking sector in China. I think then we have to look at the renminbi. And the renminbi is testing its lows around this 7 area to the dollar. We know that all the way through the 1980s and all the way through to the devaluation in 1994, the renminbi had been weakening. Then they held it artificially low for a prolonged period of time before some modest appreciation in the early 2000s. But China needs a weaker currency now because there has been a substantial migration of manufacturing. That there was data yesterday about the source of apparel that is now reaching the USA as in terms of its imports. And apparel manufacturing in China has been trending lower since about 2010, whereas Vietnamese apparel imports have been trending higher over the same period. That's representative of the fact that Chinese factories moved to Vietnam. Well, that's a major source of employment that has left China. They are in a race to move up the value chain in terms of manufacturing. They are stealing intellectual property left and right in order to achieve that goal. And they have their dual projects. One is the Silk Road Initiative or the Belt and Road Initiative, and then you have the Made in China 2025 initiatives. These are the longer term projects that China has, but they need to be competitive. And with rising wages and the fact that the manufacturing sector is leaving, the fact that the property market is at saturation, and that the financial sector is under pressure, the big question we do not know the answer to is what the natural rate of default is in China, because until about 18 months ago, there were no defaults, and now there are. So if we're thinking about where the epicenter of risk is and the market that we have to pay most attention to, it's China. It's not the USA. There is a serious temptation to think that because there have been two crashes since 2000 in the USA, that we need to have another one. Whereas China's expansion has been uninterrupted for decades. And the question is whether it can transition from being a middle-income country to a high-income country, and whether that can be achieved without massive reforms in terms of governance is very much open to question. Well, the other market to watch with regard to China is copper, but let's do so on a very long-term basis. So this is COMEX copper, and it did absolutely nothing at all but trend in a volatile manner between 1988 and 2003, and then it went through a phenomenal bull market. Well, now the big question is, what can we expect from it next? Are we in another extraordinarily volatile period where the amplitude of the range is anywhere from 100 to 450? The big question, just like we're asking with the Chinese banks and the Chinese stock market, is whether this downtrend that we've had is over. The copper price was down in a dynamic manner again in here today, but the most important thing is that it is holding its progression of lower rally highs. Then you have the gold price, and one of the fundamental drivers of the gold advance had been that China was buying lots of it. Not only is it the biggest producer, but it's also one of the biggest consumers. But gold prices are also trending lower, and they have not yet broken the progression of higher reaction lows. It certainly looked enthusiastic or encouraging at three sessions ago, but we did not get follow through on the upside, and the downtrend remains intact. So these are, I think, additional risk factors. But we have the rise of populism. The fact that because it, and I think this is exactly the same example that you have with Tesla. Tesla went out and borrowed a pile of money because it was very cheap. But governments did the same thing. Over the course of the last 30 years, we've had the rise of centrism in terms of government policy. Well, that centrism is now fraying, and we're getting a, and if a range or an inert period is an explosion waiting to happen, well, the explosion has been to the fringes. The correlation between the rise of centrism, the taking on of debt to fund social programs because of the migration of labor to the emerging markets through globalization, and the deflationary impact of technology, but not the primarily the refusal to implement the kinds of labor reforms that would be required to keep jobs at home by embracing automation rather than eschewing it. These have the only thing that has kept that system going has been the ability to take on additional debt. But if we are at now a period where at the fact of the simple or the simple fact of the matter is that the winners are now starting to lose out to the losers in terms of those that did not benefit from globalization. The people who did not benefit from globalization and from the global supply chain are now starting to outnumber those that did. And that is creating electoral change right across the world. This is not an isolated incident. It is not something that is simply going to go away. In fact, it's probably going to get worse. That is a significant challenge. And it's also something that's likely to lead to inflation, because people will simply vote themselves more money. And that money is probably going to have to come from somewhere, and it'll probably get printed. So, if that's indeed the case, then the big question is whether that is going to affect the gold price. If we do get the inflationary pressures rising as a result of a populist response to the challenges represented by a change in trend to the bond markets, then that will lead to inflation. And that's the other big risk, that the debt mountains that have been erected over the course of the last 30 years are looking toppy. And if they start to come back down, well, then we're potentially talking about an avalanche. And that is then where it isn't so much that consumers will be over-leveraged, but companies are over-leveraged. They have got an extraordinary amount of debt that's been created, and governments are over-leveraged. So if we're thinking about where the risks are in the bond markets, and the risks are in China, whereas it is the technology sector is the clear outperformer. It will certainly not be immune to pullbacks, but there are secular trends in the stock market that are unfolding, and they probably still have 15 years left to run. So that doesn't mean that we're not going to have a medium-term correction at some point, but there isn't a great deal of evidence to support the argument that it's imminent anytime soon. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.